From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
A doll. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I would have never guessed that.
What kind of doll?
Well, an ethnically Mexican looking doll. Yeah.
When images of a Frida Kahlo Barbie doll hit the internet, it raised some eyebrows because some thought it didn't quite look like her.
So there is an unibrow. I'm lucky to have one in front of me, and then I'm seen, and I know there is an unibrow.
We unpack the surprisingly charged controversy over Frida Barbie. And we talk about Mexico's recent presidential elections.
For the first time in Mexico's modern history, a party ostensibly of the left will govern.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and with me in the studio is producer Antonia Cerejido, and she's got something with her.
Okay, so Maria.
We're going to start today's show with a segment we call The Breakdown, in which our very own Antonia Cerejido explores a Latino pop culture phenomenon. So for today, the surprisingly intertwined history of two of the world's most renowned female icons, Frida Kahlo and Barbie. I'm already curious and nervous and excited and a little scared.
Good. In this box, there's an object that is currently banned in Mexico, but sold out online here in the States. What do you think it is?
What could it be? It's banned in Mexico? The first thing I thought of was something to make hot chocolate, you know, the hot chocolate makers, but no, totally not. I need some more information.
Well, let's hear the guesses from the people of the streets of Harlem.
Wait, what was the question?
It was, in this box, there is an object that is currently banned in Mexico, but sold out online in the U.S. What do you think it is?
I bet people said sex toys.
I have no idea. I don't know. Is it a sex toy?
Any type of drugs, like a vitamin.
A device for smoking marijuana.
Chipotle.
What'd you say?
Chipotle, I said. No, I don't know.
Donald Trump's autobiography.
Caja de muerto, caja de...
Muerto? And he guessed a box of the dead, which, like, quién sabe. And
I need... Give me some more. I'm going to try.
You're going to try? I'll give you a clue.
Okay.
I've been talking about it a lot.
Oh, my God. The Frida Kahlo Barbie.
Ding, ding, ding.
By the famous artist and activist Frida Kahlo, who is now one of the first dolls in the new Barbie-inspiring women's collection.
She's banned in Mexico, de verdad, de verdad?
Yeah, so
So you can't buy her?
No. And the reason you can't buy her is because Frida Kahlo's great-grandniece sued Mattel, claiming that they did not have the proper legal licensing to Frida Kahlo's image.
So the Mattel toy company creates a Frida Kahlo Barbie without ever talking to the Frida Kahlo family?
Yeah, so Mattel didn't actually work with Frida Kahlo's family. They worked with the Frida Kahlo Corporation, which is this entity that claims to hold the legal rights to Frida's image.
These family members are coming out to say something just to be able to grab a little piece of the spotlight that Frida Kahlo brings.
This is Beatriz Alvarado. She's a spokesperson for the corporation.
So I think it was very selfish.
The Frida Kahlo Corporation has been overseeing the licensing of Frida Kahlo's image on products worldwide. When I went to their website, I saw that they had licensed her image for mezcales, hotel rooms that are Frida Kahlo themed. But based on those interviews that I did on the street, it seems like the Frida Kahlo Corporation might not have done such a great job at guiding Mattel to make a Barbie that really looks like Frida Kahlo.
A doll. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I would have never guessed that.
What kind of doll?
Well, an ethnically Mexican looking doll. Yeah.
Do you recognize who it is?
No, I don't.
So who is she?
Who do you think that is?
Well, what are her eyebrows like? It's not Frida Kahlo. Because there's a hint of a unibrow, but not an entire unibrow.
But if you ask Beatrice about this...
The Barbie has an unibrow, a soft unibrow. So there is an unibrow, and I'm lucky to have one in front of me, and then I'm seeing, and I know there is an unibrow.
So I can confirm there is a very faint unibrow, but it's kind of hard to see unless you look really close. Regardless, it seems like the doll did not fully capture the essence of Frida Kahlo. I mean, however, like, the doll is beautiful. She has these intricate braids with little red flowers in them and this red shawl and golden, seemingly Aztec-inspired jewelry. But the real-life Frida had one leg longer than the other, a broken spine, and this doll just has, like, that perfect-proportioned Barbie body. And the doll just seems, like, girlier, plainer, and just not quite Frida. I reached out to Mattel multiple times for an interview about the doll, and after a lot of back and forth, they stopped responding to my emails. This was back in March when they first announced the doll for International Women's Day, and they announced the doll alongside other famous, quote, inspiring role model dolls like Amelia Earhart and filmmaker Ava DuVernay, but it was this Frida Barbie doll that got the most attention. I mean, we saw in our office just like the Twitter explosion that happened once this doll was announced was crazy. There were people on Twitter saying that this was abomination, that Frida Kahlo must be rolling in her grave. Frida Kahlo was this radical leftist figure who didn't adhere to Western beauty standards. And Barbie is like the ultimate symbol of Western beauty standards. Then there were other people who were like, finally, more representation. You know, Barbie is like the most recognized doll brand in America, and they should be representing a diverse group of women. So that's the whole conversation online.
Hi.
Hi.
When I talk to actual kids about the doll.
What are your names?
My name is Zoe, and she's Sophia.
So I am Sophia.
They seem to like it. Do you guys play with dolls?
Yeah.
What do you think about this doll?
That doll, that's so cute. That doll,
there is something about this doll that incites very strong reactions. Seeing how intensely people defended or dismissed the doll, I became kind of obsessed. And so I've done a lot of reading and talking to serious Barbie and Frida experts, and what I've learned is that although Frida Kahlo and Barbie might seem opposed to each other, they actually share one big similarity, which is that they've both been very influential in how we think about what it means to be a modern woman. We're going to do some serious unpacking of both Frida Kahlo and Barbie's backstories, because while I thought I knew a lot about them, there are a lot of surprising details that I am straight up pumped to share with you. But first, the basics. Frida Kahlo was a painter. She was a communist.
Radical, revolutionary, bisexual.
She was all those things. Frida Kahlo was born in 1907 in Mexico City to a mestiza mother and a...
German father.
German-Jewish.
German-Jewish? I didn't know about the Jewish part.
Do you know the name of the woman who created Barbie?
No.
Her name was Ruth Handler, but her birth name was Ruth Moscow, and she was the daughter of two Polish-Jewish immigrants. For the story, I spoke to M.G. Lord, who is the author of a book called Forever Barbie. It was the first book to really do a deep dive into the history of the doll.
The Handlers were second-generation Jewish immigrants, and their approach to toys was very similar to the approach that the Jewish studio moguls took toward the making of films.
MG is talking about the heads of major movie studios in the 1950s, like Louis B. Mayer of MGM and Adolf Zucker of Paramount. They were also Jewish. They were immigrants themselves. They produced movies that portrayed this very white, very Anglo version of the United States.
The films created an impossible America, an America that was so American that no one could really belong to it. It was a myth.
Where's your mother?
We're looking for you.
With Uncle Billy.
Daddy! Zuzu, my little ginger snap, how do you feel?
Fine.
Not if Mitchum kept...
And then they colonized the imaginations of more recent and less recent immigrants with this idea of an idealized white America that didn't even exist.
That's one of the problems that I had with Barbie, frankly. Even though I had the little Barbie house and I had the Ken, it was always like, this is impossible and this is unattainable and it is entirely fake.
The thing is, though, just as Barbie played up her quote-unquote Americanness, Frida Kahlo also played up her own Mexican indigenous identity, starting with the way she dressed. The peasant shirts, the embroidery, the flowers.
The long, flowy skirt, mm-hmm. oftentimes involving a headdress sometimes.
Yeah, the classic Frida look. And it's actually the traditional Tehuana outfit. The Tehuana dresses are known for being colorful and intricate. And Tehuantepec, the region in Oaxaca where the dresses come from, is known for being a historically matriarchal society, which Frida loved. No one in Frida's family or social circle, which was this upper class, bourgeois, intellectual circle, actually wore clothes like that. But Frida did, and it was because she was taking a definitive stance to look more Mexican and more indigenous. And she also did something that I think is really funny, which is she lied all the time about when her birthday was and told everyone that it was the year that the Mexican Revolution started.
So the thing about Frida Kahlo also is that she was making a statement as, I want to actively own my indigenous roots, whether or not I can clearly, definitively tie them so deeply, which is something that, again, someone like me also did. My cousins in Mexico made fun of me when I would wear this type of shirt or huaraches, because it was like, what are you trying to, like, own something that you're not? And I felt like I was trying to say, no, but this is me. This is me. I have to wear this because I want you to see that I'm Mexican. And at the same time, you know, like Frida, the truth is that I have that privilege to choose to wear those clothes when not everybody does.
Frida was making a political statement by wearing those clothes. She wanted to associate herself with working class Mexicans. She was part of the Mexicanidad movement along with Diego Rivera, who would later become her husband. And they were both like super involved in leftist causes. They were members of the Mexican Communist Party. They even took in communist exiles like Leon Trotsky into their home. Diego was also a painter, and he was very famous in his own lifetime for his murals, which would depict working-class Mexicans and also famous scenes in Mexico's history in which he put indigenous people in the forefront as a way of reclaiming Mexico's history. So both Ruth Handler, the creator of Barbie, and Frida herself were very aware of the fact that they were creating very strong nationalistic symbols. Barbie was the quintessential American girl, and Frida had made herself into the quintessential Mexican woman. And the first Frida self-portrait and the first Barbie...
No, don't tell me they come the same year?
No, actually, they're very far apart in time. No. But they do have weird parallels. And in general, there are all these strange parallels between Frida and Barbie, and I want to go through some of them.
But we're going to have to wait to listen to them till after the break. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Fifth Generation Inc., maker of 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. Distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, recognizing the contributions of American immigrants in its Great Immigrants, Great Americans program this July. More at carnegie.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, producer Antonia Cerejido was talking about the parallels between Frida Kahlo and Barbie's stories. And we're going to jump back in, comparing the origin story of the very first Barbie and Frida Kahlo's very first self-portrait.
Frida paints her first self-portrait in 1926. And the reason she paints her first self-portrait is actually really tragic. In 1925, she went through a horrible trolley accident that severed her spine into five pieces. An entire pole just impales her pelvis. At the time, she had her high school boyfriend was this guy named Alejandro, and she just wrote him these really long love letters. And she was really depressed because he wouldn't go visit her. And so to win him back, she painted a self-portrait of herself that looks really different than the sort of image that we think of when we think of Frida Kahlo. This is it.
I was going to say, this is her first one?
Mm-hmm.
It's the most traditional of her self-portraits.
It's notable partly for its lack of color. It's like all dark shades of browns and blacks. Normally, we associate Frida with these like bright colors and like also her just intense, penetrating gaze. In this painting, she kind of looks like coy. Like her gaze is soft and her head is a little cocked to the side. And again, she made this painting to send it to her boyfriend at the time. So that is the story of the first Frida Kahlo portrait. I asked MG Lord, the author of Forever Barbie, to tell me about the first Barbie.
When Barbie was first introduced at Toy Fair in 1959, she sank like a stone. The male toy buyers were made really uncomfortable by what they saw as, well, what the doll was based on, a slightly pornographic gag gift for men.
Oh my God.
Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
The inspiration for Barbie came from when Ruth Handler was in Germany. Weirdly, Germany plays a role in all of this. she was in Germany and she was walking by a store and she saw a 3D model doll that was this like sex toy based on this like comic strip in Germany. And she thought that little girls in America would love to play with it. The reason she liked it is because she'd noticed that her daughter and her daughter's friends would play with cutout paper dolls and that they loved to dress them. Because previously to this, all of the dolls that little girls played with were baby dolls.
But Barbie invited a whole new way of engaging with dolls, you know, projecting your adult identity onto this thing, playing out an adult life. And an adult life, interestingly, with no positions of responsibility. There were no parents in Barbie's world. There were no children in Barbie's world. You know, Barbie was on her own.
Barbie came out in the late 1950s, and World War II had just ended. Americans were going through what is now known as the golden age of capitalism. It was this time where the economy was booming, and many blue-collar workers were experiencing home ownership or even vacations for the first time. And it was in that environment that little girls were playing with the first Barbies. Immediately, little girls loved the doll, but moms hated it. They were like, I'm not giving my daughter a pornographic doll. Then Ruth Handler hired a psychologist to do a survey of daughters and mothers to see how they could try to sell the doll. And what he found was that even the, quote, homeliest of girls would want to, like, brush Barbie's hair and learn how to primp her and put her in dresses. And then it actually became sold to mothers as a way of teaching your daughter how to make themselves up in a way that a man will like.
Whoa. Put on the clothes, see what it looks like. Maybe then you want to wear those same clothes and see what it looks like.
Exactly.
Someday I'm gonna be exactly like you. Till then I know just what I'll do. Barbie, beautiful Barbie. I'll make believe that I am you.
You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
So it is this thing of like, yeah, it's you in the future, but it's a version of you that is palatable to the male gaze.
Got it.
But Frida Kahlo's portrait, made for the male gaze, the first one. This doll, made for the male gaze.
Got it.
But I think beyond this idea of the male gaze, the idea that a little girl can project her identity onto the Barbie has a more interesting parallel to the Frida Kahlo portraits. Frida is famous for painting self-portraits, and after her trolley accident, she had very limited mobility, so in a way, her paintings acted as her avatars, going places where she couldn't. And when little kids play with Barbies, they're portraying themselves into a world that they can't access, like adult world. And I think that that's a really cool parallel between Frida having her portrait as an avatar and the Barbie acting as like an avatar for a little kid. But then there are a couple of other parallels I find really amusing. Barbie has her dream house that's very famous.
Barbie! I just moved into my newest, biggest dream house ever.
Oh, and Frida Kahlo has her blue house, which is also very famous. Both were part of iconic relationships. Obviously, Barbie and Ken. And then Frida and Diego.
Ahora bien, ¿qué cosa es el arte? ¿Por qué desde los primeros pasos de la humanidad en la Tierra?
I find the idea of women going goo-goo over a guy who talks like this with this crazy stern voice. And also, Diego Rivera, his looks were not, let's just say he didn't really look like Ken. I find the idea of girls going crazy over him really funny. But in his lifetime, he actually was a big ladies' man. So Diego and Frida had a very tumultuous, very loving at times, but really intense relationship. Up until Frida's passing, together they traveled across the U.S. They made a lot of international friends. But during the last years of Frida's life, she couldn't travel very much because she just never fully recovered from her trolley accident. In 1953, when Frida was 46, she finally had her first and what would ultimately be her last solo show that she could attend. Frida's doctor had told her that she was not in a good enough condition to go to the opening of the show. But she was like, I don't care what he says. I want to go. It's my first solo show. And so she gets on a stretcher. They, like, take her on a stretcher. They put her on a truck. She gets to the gallery. And then she's just taken around the gallery on the stretcher. She gets to greet all of her friends and family. And a year later, while gravely ill with pneumonia, Frida dies in her home. The first Barbie came out 4 years after, so they actually never existed during the same time. And so this is the first Barbie. She's iconic. It's the one wearing that, like, black and white bathing suit. Her blonde hair is in a ponytail, and she has this, like, dainty, pointy face.
The faces of these Barbies, the very early, this is more similar to the Barbies that I was playing with.
To me, the most startling thing is that the early Barbies, their eyes look to the side. They wouldn't look at you in the face. They had averted eyes.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, until the 70s. That was right. The women's movement, they're like, oh, I guess Barbie is allowed to look at people and not have to look away.
Let's go shopping with Barbie.
It's in the late 60s, early 70s, as the women's movement and other counterculture movements are taking off, that Barbie sales start to sink for the first time. You can even feel how unpopular she was at this time in this depressing Barbie commercial from 1970.
Sure, dolls are fun.
I love being a fashion model.
But both Frida and Barbie were about to have a big resurgence. Frida first, in the late 70s, as an icon for the emerging Chicana movement. I spoke to Amalia Mesa Baines, who is a Chicana artist, and she remembers seeing Frida's art close up when she went to Mexico City for the first time.
And I got a chance to see the large painting of Frida Kahlo's Dos Fridas, which to me is a purely Chicana painting. It's about two identities that make peace with each other.
In the painting, there are two versions of Frida sitting next to each other, connected by a bleeding heart. One is wearing a Victorian dress and the other a Tijuana dress. It seems to be a commentary on her mixed race identity.
I felt always that those were the things we were struggling with, trying to be American when we were still to some degree Mexican or in this case, Chicana.
Amalia related to Frida's depiction of being caught between two worlds, but it was more than that. Frida's radical politics resonated with her as well.
When I say I am a Chicana, I'm saying to you, I have political values about equity and I want things to change.
So at the same time that Frida is becoming this big Chicana symbol, something else is happening in the U.S. for women, which is that women start to enter, particularly the corporate workforce, in droves. This is like peak Donna Summers, she works hard for her money years. From 1972 to 1985, women's share of professional jobs went up 5%, which doesn't seem huge. But during that time, management jobs nearly doubled. So, like, women entering the workforce is this, like, whole thing. And all of a sudden,
Barbie and Barbie's weird body was back in vogue. Large breasts, broad shoulders with those shoulder pads.
And I think the best representation of why Barbie was big in the 80s is this amazing commercial for Day to Night Barbie.
Here's Day to Night Barbie. Day to Night Ken sold separately.
We girls make work and lots of fun.
Right, Barbie?
Day to Night Barbie.
Meet briefcase and stuff.
I had a change around outfit for sure.
Yeah.
For her. I don't remember if it was like work to, but you know, the change around outfits for Barbie were a big deal.
But yeah, there was this idea of like, you can have it all. You can work in your high corporate office and then you go out and have fun. One thing that is very important in both Barbie and Frida's trajectory is the fact that they were childless. Frida, not by choice. And Barbie, very much by choice. Barbie was revolutionary in the sense that, like, her main thing was, like, to work and make money and spend money. That was, like, Barbie's whole shindig.
The American woman. Independent
exactly.
With money.
And Frida herself was known for having an independent identity. She was famous for her work, for her painting, not just for being a wife or a mother. And it is while women are debating the classic question, how do you balance your personal life and career, that Frida really starts to gain global recognition. Frida mania just goes bonkers, bananas, nuts. Like, it just explodes. And it's largely because of the publication of a book. Frida, a biography of Frida Kahlo by Hayden Herrera in 1983. It was the first time somebody had gathered all of this information, all of these private journals, all of these artifacts and interviews to create one book that encompassed what Frida's experience was like. Even though the book had a lot of context and information about the political, historical movements in Mexico, what people seemed to latch onto was the racy interpersonal history and the passionate love letters that Frida wrote in her youth. Amalia felt like she was watching on the sidelines as her favorite Chicana icon was becoming depoliticized.
It was as though the only thing that mattered to Frida Kahlo was her love life. First with the young man when she was, you know, a teenager, young, and then later with Diego. They were both political activist artists in a period of enormous change in Mexico. So I always felt that that part of her story has dropped away.
Frida was becoming a global icon and also a major moneymaker. The biggest art auction houses, Christie's and Sotheby's, had been doing the Latin American art auction for years and would feature big Mexican muralists like Siqueiros and Rivera.
But then Frida gets discovered and she becomes then a vehicle for investment.
And the thing about this new Frida mania is that in most cases, Frida's ideas or her politics were not center stage. It seemed to be primarily her image that people loved and identified with. And so we start to see Frida on posters, on pins, on prints, on t-shirts, on hats, on anything, on mugs, you name it. And ultimately, Frida becomes what Barbie has always been, a consumer product. In 1989, Elle magazine did a photo shoot inspired by Frida.
Those models parodied Carlo, but completely left out the issues that she struggled with throughout her life, her own disability, or as she herself said in an interview, she wasn't sick, she was broken.
This is Oriana Baddeley. She's a British art historian, and she's the first person to ever write about the phenomenon of Frida mania. Oriana noticed that the same way Barbie had come to embody the ultimate American woman, Frida Kahlo had come to embody
the ultimate exotic woman.
I didn't come here for fun or to flirt.
Frida was played by Salma Hayek in 2002 for the movie Frida. The film features many Mexican actors. It's set in Mexico. It's about a Mexican icon, and yet it was in English.
To Diego and Frida.
Diego and Frida.
And people are still obsessed with Frida Kahlo. If you go to Etsy, the online website where people sell handmade goods, there are over 16,000 Frida-themed objects. Her home in Mexico, La Casa Azul, has become a mecca of sorts for feminists and art lovers. And Barbie also continues to be a culturally relevant icon. Just in May, Saturday Night Live did a skit parodying Barbie's supposed Instagram account.
Welcome to your first day as interns at Mattel, the Barbie division.
Who is Barbie? Barbie is fun. Barbie works hard and plays thoughtfully. She has one boyfriend. She is impossible. She is girl to the max. Barbie is current. You understand?
I have been spending a really stupid amount of time thinking about Frida Kahlo and Barbie as symbols. And Frida and Barbie today have had their image plastered in so many places and have saturated the market for so long that at this point, they're just symbols that people apply whatever it is they want to see on them, on them.
That was what I was afraid of, truthfully.
Yeah.
I was afraid of that because, as happens in the United States of America, with something that we used to call, way back when, cultural imperialism, mm-hmm. right? I was just like, se van a tomar a Frida también. They're going to take Frida too. You know, but I also understand that by Frida becoming so popular, everything that she represents, you know, Mexico, the rejection of Western standards of beauty, a kind of her questioning around gender and sexuality, if that becomes more popular, then that's pretty cool too.
Right. No, totally. I mean, this is like an old debate about what it means that a communist figure is so commercially popular. So Oriana is like, has been one of the biggest critics of Frida mania. And so I asked her, I was like, what do you think about this Frida Barbie? What do you think about it?
It's very hard to say that one supports anything about Mattel and Barbie, but at the same time, I think they have made an effort to do something different. It is sort of interesting.
Wow, you're really surprising me right now.
I know. But the idea of dressing up a doll, I think, could be done quite creatively, and it could well appeal to young children to do something different.
So she likes the Frida doll for the purpose of little girls using the Frida doll as a piece of art. God, I kind of love that.
Despite the fact that Frida Kahlo and Barbie have been these deeply entrenched cultural icons and symbols, little kids just don't know any of that information. And so when they approach this doll, they're giving it their own life and their own meaning.
This is how she looks like.
Ooh, ah. Take off the plastic.
Ooh, pretty.
Coming up on Latino USA, unpacking the results of the recent elections in Mexico. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org. And the Annenberg Foundation, committed to supporting, educating, and engaging communities in the United States and globally for more than 25 years. Learn more at AnnenbergFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And there's been some really big news from Mexico recently. Left-leaning nationalist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador was elected as Mexico's new president in a landslide victory with 53% of the votes. That means that for the first time in almost 100 years, Mexico will not be ruled by the same two major incumbent parties. López Obrador, also known as AMLO, is taking the reins during a challenging time for Mexico. There's an ongoing security crisis, intensifying battles over trade, and migration with the United States. To talk more about what this historic election means for Mexico, I'm joined by political analyst Denise Dresser. She joins us from Mexico City. Denise, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hola, buenos días.
So there's been talk of this being a historic election for Mexico. He did displace the two traditional parties. But why else is this a historic election?
It's historic because for the first time in Mexico's modern history, a party ostensibly of the left will govern. It's historic because this is the third time that López Obrador has run. He ran back in 2006 and argued that fraud was committed against him.
Expreso mi decisión de rechazar.
He ran in 2012. And did not reach the presidency by a long shot. And now, his third time around, he capitalized on the anger, the disaffection, the discontent with the PRI's rule. We saw corruption, we saw impunity, we saw structural reforms that benefited the few at the expense of the many. And in the last 10 years,
Mexico's bloody drug war has lasted over a decade.
A war on drugs that ended up being a war on Mexicans. Over 250,000 people who've been killed, over 34,000 people who are missing. And López Obrador's narrative ever since he ran for the presidency back in 2006 has essentially been the same narrative. He is anti-elites, anti-establishment, anti-status quo. And reality finally caught up with him. The level of corruption in this administration under Enrique Peña Nieto, the level of violence, the sense of entitlement of elites, he captured this. He understood this. He went from town to town, adding fuel to the fire of anger and of resentment, and also, I think, imbuing the population with a sense of hope that change was possible.
There's a new president for Mexico. Obrador is a left-wing populist and severe critic of President Trump's immigration policies.
Give us a sense of who is AMLO.
he comes from the provinces. He's from a small town in Tabasco. His critics have called him the tropical messiah because he comes from the tropics, and he has a sense of his place in history. He views himself as a continuation of some of the founding fathers of Mexico, and he has pursued politics with a missionary zeal.
Así como ustedes me quieren a mí, les quiero yo a ustedes. Y un poquito más todavía.
Combined in recent times with a pragmatism that we hadn't seen since he was mayor back in between 2000 and 2006.
En la Ciudad de México hay un problema de vialidad serio porque son las mismas calles.
He did not antagonize investors. He built highways. He gave out pensions to the elderly and to unwed mothers.
Hizo los ejes viales porque se tendrían que tirar casas.
He wasn't a radical, nor was he particularly transformative. He has a long trajectory of fighting against established politicians in Mexico, of pointing out rampant corruption. And he said, I will sweep the staircase from the top down. Now, that sounds great, but it doesn't really tell you how Mexico will use its institutions to combat corruption.
So the campaign in Mexico, AMLO's campaign and the other candidates, really was a conversation about the national politics of Mexico. But AMLO did make sure to present himself as a strong man who will stand up to President Trump.
Vamos a respetar al presidente Donald Trump, pero va a tener que aprender a respetar.
Give us a sense of the AMLO-Trump relationship that we might see in the future.
I think there will be a change in terms of the rhetoric at the very least, because what we saw under Peña Nieto was a very weak and very unpopular president trying to stand up to a bully, but without having the domestic backing to do so. I think at least rhetorically, López Obrador will take a stronger stance against Donald Trump. I think he'll probably try to wait it out and hope for a normalization of U.S.-Mexico relations when Trump is out of office.
As a political scientist, you're coming at this election with a real critical eye. A lot of people are just like, oh my God, there's a tremendous amount of expectations. This is historic. Things are going to change. And you're saying manage your expectations and not so fast. Why?
Because I've been there before. 30 million people voted for López Obrador, and he has won this election with a 31-point margin. Expectations now are huge also because this is an ostensibly left-leaning government that has promised profound transformation. But I have seen how quickly expectations can be undermined by the reality of Mexico. And the reality is that López Obrador has constructed a modified version of the PRI. Morena became a catch-all party in this election. And it's full of former members of the PRI. And he has not said a word about doing away with the clientelist corporatist pacts of the past. And that goes against this demand for transparency, accountability, checks and balances that is the demand that should be guiding the transition and not simply replacing the PRI with another party that looks a lot like it and could end up governing a lot like it.
What just happened in Mexico was much more than just the election for president. There's a new Congress, there's new governors, there's mayors, local representatives.
Now he has a much bigger platform, much more power. His party is going to have a majority in Congress, and it's going to be the majoritarian party in the Senate as well. So he will be able to wield the executive and the legislative branch in whatever direction he wants. So So what lies ahead in truth is terra incognita. We don't know what sort of president he's going to be.
Denise Dresser, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Denise Dresser is a political analyst, writer, and professor based in Mexico City. We're going to end today with a segment we call How I Made It, stories about Latino creators and the work they make. And today, we're going to hear from Angelica Negron, Jose Olivares, and Raul Raimundi. They're three Puerto Ricans who live in Brooklyn. And you could say that these friends live a double life. During the day, they go to what some might consider nerdy jobs.
I'm a teaching artist for the New York Philharmonic and for Lincoln Center Education, working with learners of all ages.
I work with the New York City Department of Education. I work with the Computer Science for All initiative.
I currently work for a startup as a project manager.
But at night, they play shows as part of the tropical indie band, Balloon. The band formed over a decade ago in Puerto Rico, and now they're putting out their first album in 8 years. Here's Angelica, Jose, and Raul telling us about the band's comeback and their latest single, El Espanto.
Balloon sounds like music that you could sleep to while dancing. It's full of colors and textures
and beats
that hopefully want to make you want to move.
Yeah.
So Balloon started in Rio Piedras, Puerto Rico, and Jose and I were studying film in college. We were studying together, we were making films together, and we also felt the need for making music for some of those films as well. So we started making music.
So Dreambo is a term that we invented, pretty much mashing up two things that we like a lot, the dream pop. And then also the dembow rhythm from Jamaica. So in Puerto Rico, the history of reggaeton has a lot to do with the dembow rhythm. So we grew up with that rhythm, but we never like used it in our music until we moved to New York. And then we just started like experimenting with the dembow rhythm. So at one point we were like, oh, we're just making like dreambo. I started working on El Espanto because I was teaching music production to teenagers in the South Bronx. As part of my job, I had to kind of like practice and make songs and learn how to make beats that the kids were asking me to do. Like, I want to make like a trap beat. And I'm like, okay, let me figure out how to make one and teach it. So for El Espanto in particular, I wanted to make something that was like very rhythmically. So I started with the bass line. The bass line is all completely programmed. And for some accident, it came sounding like very like salsa-like. And then I was like, okay, I think this one has a potential of like bringing the dembow rhythm. So we started with the bass line and then the dembow rhythm. Because the whole dembow thing, like no one associated that with Balloon, and we were kind of like playing to a new crowd and an older crowd, and we were like, let's do something. Like, okay, this is the dembow rhythm. That's going to blow their minds because they would never imagine Balloon using the dembow or like a reggaeton type beat. And then we were like, okay, so on top of that, let's just go crazy at the end and then just put like a jungle loop. at the end. So it was kind of like making the audience go through different stages of like accepting Balloon, like, oh, first, this doesn't make sense. Then you're like, oh, this might make sense. And then at the end, you're like, whoa, what the hell happened?
And I also see it as also different stages of like a cleansing. So this person that kind of needs some type of work done so they can go on with their lives, because there's definitely something not quite right there. So you're acknowledging it and then naming it and then actually doing the cleansing at the end of the song where it gets a little crazy.
For a band like Balloon that we've been doing this for so long, that we're still doing things that people like and that we have like new things to show and new ideas to express and that we're reaching a new audience, makes us feel like our music is growing up, but also it still sounds fresh.
Angélica Negrón, José Olivares, and Raúl Raimundi of the Puerto Rican band Balloon. Their new album, Prisma Tropical, drops in July. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Gidi Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Special thanks to director Andrea Nevins, whose documentary Tiny Shoulders about the history of Barbie provided necessary context for this episode. You can check it out on Hulu. And also to Flor de Toloache, who allowed us to use their music for this episode. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Also, my dear listener, I want to tell you about something really exciting. This year, Latino USA turns 25. And on Sunday, August 12th in New York City, we're teaming up with the City Park Summer Stage to celebrate with Grammy winner Jerry Rivera, New Yorican poet La Bruja, and percussionist Chembo Corniel. Come out and party with the Latino USA team in New York City's East River Park, and I'll see you there. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on the next episode, and in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at heisingsimons.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity.
Barbie doll hit the Immerdet. Immerdet, did you hear that? I made up a new word, the Immerdet.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working alongside others to build a culture of health that provides everyone in America a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org. And the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children, and the vitality of arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.